Welcome to another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast, a production of the Criminal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School in Charlottesville, Virginia. Every 2 weeks, we release a new episode. Today, we're going to have a conversation about a recent opinion from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Please note that these episodes may contain facts and circumstances surrounding criminal trials. Listener discretion is advised.
Rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America at this moment.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of Criminal Law Presents CAF Chats. Today, instead of our normal episode where we digest a CAF opinion, we have the distinct pleasure of being joined by Professor David Schlieder, who recently gave the 18th annual George S. Prue Lecture in Military Legal History. He was here at the school to talk about the 75th anniversary of the passage of the Uniform Code of Military Justice and to give general comments on trends and issues that he's seen throughout the code's history. I had the distinct pleasure of sitting down with him after he gave the lecture to the grad course and other members of the TJAGLIX faculty and staff, and got to talk to him about five trends that he noted over the course of the history of the Uniform Code of Military Justice that have persisted and will likely persist going forward. For those of you that are familiar with the practice of military justice, you probably recognize Professor Schlieder's name. He's on your Evidence Foundations book. So whether you've owned the blue book, like I first got, the green book, or the red book, the most three recent iterations, you are definitely familiar with his work. After a career in the JAG Corps, including teaching here at the JAG School, in 1983, Professor Schlieder accepted a position on the law faculty at St. Mary's University of Texas. There, he has taught evidence, trial advocacy, constitutional law, and criminal procedure. In 2002 and 2018, he was named the outstanding law faculty member. And in 2018, he was named the Hardy Chair Emeritus. And in May 2022, he was named Professor Emeritus. He swears to me he's kind of retired, but it doesn't really sound like it when you look at his career. So I hope that you enjoy the next 20 minutes or so of the conversation that he and I undertook, and we will be back to our regularly scheduled episode where we digest an opinion next week. Thank you all, as always. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Criminal Law Presents. Today we have a special grab bag episode. I have the pleasure of being joined by Professor Emeritus David Schlieder. If you've read the Evidence Foundations book, yes, it is that person that's in front of me here today that I have the pleasure of speaking to. Sir, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. Thank you very much for having me.
Great. So you just delivered the Prue lecture here at the schoolhouse, and I thought this would be a perfect opportunity to have you on and discuss general military justice topics with you. And I want to talk about something that you said to the students in your speech. And you talked about five trends that you've seen. And would it be okay if we go through each of those and kind of
sure,
discuss them?
Sure, that'd be fine.
Okay. So the first one you talked about is the shift from discipline to justice in the military justice system. Do you mind explaining to our viewers what you mean when you think about that?
Sure. Years ago, I did an article on the military justice conundrum because I'd been studying that issue for a number of years and kind of struggled with it in terms of what is the primary purpose of our military justice system. And after going through the research and going back to basically even the Articles of War and reading articles and studies that have been done, I came to the conclusion that the primary purpose of our military justice system is to ensure good order and discipline. Now, that's a somewhat controversial term because we sometimes have negative connotations for discipline, but I came to the conclusion that that was the primary purpose. But as I was doing research for my paper, which was published in the Military Law Review, I ran across the preamble to the Manual for Courts Martial, 1984. And the preamble lists justice first, and then discipline. And I called some friends who had worked on that 1984 manual, and no one seemed to remember who came up with that language, because my question was, when did it change? And so that was the first time I really became aware of the fact that there was a trend to emphasize the justice functions of military justice, which is clearly an important role. But there's ambiguity in the term justice. So when you say, well, we're going to bring the accused to justice, I take it people or me, we're going to bring them to a conviction which will promote good order and discipline. So yes, I don't know that you could point to a specific event or a specific case. It's just a trend that I've noticed where more and more you tend to see people arguing that it's a system of justice, maybe perhaps to get more beneficial attention from the public. I don't know.
Yeah, and the way you framed it earlier was interesting to me, too. You talked about a shift from efficiency when we're talking about good or indiscipline to due process and justice. Do you care to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I was using that in the context of a law review article I read years ago by a professor, Herbert Packer, who argued that there are two competing models in any criminal justice system. One is a crime control model, and one is a due process model. And if you go through each, as I did, you go through each of the major functions, nonjudicial punishment, preferring charges, pretrial confinement, you ask yourself, is the primary purpose, for example, of nonjudicial punishment, is that to provide due process, or is that to ensure some speedy discipline? And so as you go through those, you realize, and Packard even mentioned this, that the due process model was an obstacle. It slowed things down. It was the primacy of the individual as opposed to primacy of the public. And military justice faces those same dilemmas. In other words, if you believe that the primary purpose of the system is to provide justice and due process, I think naturally the end result will be a slower system. There'll be more attention paid to the dotting the I's and crossing the T's. I'm not suggesting you cut corners, but I think that that's one of the results.
Yeah, and I think that recent trends would probably agree with you. I know as a practitioner, I've been doing this for a little over a decade now, 12 years. I've definitely seen an increase in the time that it takes from crime committed till court-martial complete, and especially when you consider appellate review, you're talking years, like definitely not weeks or months, mm-hmm. You're talking years. And you and I talked just before this, and I attributed it to maybe the complexity and the seriousness of the cases increasing. Like maybe the accused is more due process when the severity of the crime and the severity of the possible punishment increases. Do you think that has something to do with it?
I think so. And if you take a look even at the civilian system in terms of the technology that's now available, I think the jury expects there's going to be a CSI type of evidence. That there'll be fingerprints, that there'll be DNA. And I've heard from prosecutors for the last several decades that they sometimes hesitate to try a case, not because they don't believe they have evidence, but just because the forensic evidence isn't there to back it up, because the juries are expecting more. And I can imagine the same would be true in the military. And the defense counsel know that they could argue constitutional protections to the military judge to have access to not only one expert, but perhaps two experts, at government expense. And so by the time you work through all that, you're losing weeks. Then you have to deal, I think, as you mentioned, with the schedule of the expert. But it's all part of that due process approach. And I think the public demands it. I mean, if I were defense counsel right now in the military, I would ask for every ounce of protection that my client was entitled to, including those benefits, even if it costs time. Time is on my side as a defense counsel, as we talked about.
Yeah, and I think in any legitimate system, like you have to make sure that we're doing it right. So I'm 100% on board with you there. Okay, shifting to your second point and trend that you've seen over the course and the greater topic of the course of the history of the UCMJ and the changes. You talked about a shift from a command-centric focus to a lawyer-centric focus.
Yes.
Care to explain that a little bit more?
Yes, I think that the role of the commander today is definitely much more diminished than it was even 10, 15, 20 years ago. When I was on active duty in the 70s and prosecuting cases at Fort Belvoir, I took the position that my client was the commander. I was the JAG, and I gave him the best legal advice that I possibly could. But the ultimate decision as to whether to hit the start button on a court-martial was in the hands of the commander. That's pretty much gone today. I think the public expects that lawyers are going to drive the system. And what really has been curious to me is whether lawyers wearing uniforms have actually promoted the use of lawyers in the system. In other words, we're pretty good at looking after our own interest. And I think, and I've also talked with senior commanders who say, I'm going to call my judge to find out what to do, and I'm going to follow that person's advice. And so one of the side effects of gaining the trust of a commander is that commanders go increasingly to the JAGs. In fact, here at the JAG School, for decades, we've had the Senior Officer Legal Orientation course. And the evaluations in that course are usually very high because individuals who are taking battalion or brigades are more than happy to know that they've got smart lawyers there to help them stay out of trouble. And I think that simply promotes this idea that lawyers should have more of a say. Plus, you have the expansion of the role of military judges. Back in the day, military judges generally didn't have any authority to act on a case until after referral of the charges. Now, thanks to amendments to UCMJ, military judges are involved at a very early stage, dealing with pretrial matters, issuing subpoenas, dealing with motions to quash subpoenas. So I think it's been a conglomeration of things. I don't want to say it was just the lawyers expanding their own role. It was actually changes in the UCMJ that helped.
I mean, and one of those big ones that comes immediately to my mind is the creation of the Office of the Special Trial Counsel. I mean, you have lawyers directly making charging and referral
Absolutely.
Decisions.
So, I mean, Absolutely.
There's definitely been, even in recent years, and I agree with you, that the role of the military judges has kind of increased exponentially when it comes to pretrial matters. We'll be curious to see where it goes over the course of the next few years.
And the something that I remember in the debate, and I was generally opposed to the Office of Special Trial Counsel. I thought it was a mistake to bifurcate our system. I saw it slowing things down. I anticipated a kind of an ivory tower approach, you know, where major decisions would be made outside the local command. But I know that the pushback on that was that there were very few so-called convening authorities. There were some retired JAGs who said, well, you're only dealing with a handful of general court-martial convening authorities. And I said, no, the way the system is going to work is that all commanders in the chain of command are going to be cut out. In other words, currently, if it's not one of the covered offenses, you get a company commander weighing in, you get battalion commander, brigade commander, and finally the division commander or installation commander. And so it's not just the final convening authority who would be cut out of the system. It would be all the lower ranking commanders who might have a say. And I always thought that was a good idea. In other words, you had the benefit, if you're the commanding general, you're getting the views of the subordinate commanders who are closer to the situation as to their recommendations. So under the new system, they're all gone.
Yeah, it's definitely a sea change. It will be interesting to see like what kind of effect that has over the course of the next few years. We're about 18 months in right now, so still some lessons to learn.
Indeed.
For sure. Okay, third point. So UCI, Unlawful Command Influence, always kind of existed in the system, always kind of there as a specter. What do you think of it as a general trend in military justice?
I think it's going to continue. I find it personally very frustrating. I think, as I shared this morning, when I read cases about UCI, so many of those cases are avoidable. It was just a slip of the tongue. It was somebody not thinking ahead. It was somebody not paying attention to the fact that whatever they said might have an impact. Maybe it was an informal setting, then the word gets back that the old man wants to see a conviction in this case, and it's not what he intended, but then you have a problem of it being litigated. So, you know, the court said decades ago that UCI was a mortal enemy of military justice, and I couldn't agree more. And I think my level of frustration is that I don't know that there is an easy fix. In my speech, I mentioned, well, maybe one way to try to stem it is to reverse more cases. That if you do find that it took place, you presume prejudice. And that would mean that guilty people would walk free. So that's not a good solution. And I think what's going to take place is somebody needs to keep analyzing this. Because as I mentioned, Professor Morgan, who was, you know, the architect of the UCMJ in 1950, himself in an article years later said, if the military can't get rid of UCI, then maybe the only solution is to shift everything over to civilian prosecutors.
Yeah, and it does seem to pop up like on the radar every once in a while. I can think of two CAF cases over the course of the last 5 years or so where it's featured front and center, maybe three if you go back to Bergdahl. But yes, and the statutes have obviously changed on this a little bit. And so the way to grapple with UCI is very different. So with the changes to Article 37 and with Article 59 Alpha kind of always being there, what those mean for the audience is you have to prove individual prejudice to an individual accused.
Yes.
And when we talk about UCI, we're always talking about two concepts. There's actual UCI where you talk about where the commander's like, this person needs to go to jail. Like that seems to be pretty like evident that that's a prejudice to the accused. Mm-hmm. I think where the problem lies is when you have apparent UCI and it's harm to the system. And I know you and I talked about what do you do when you have to show prejudice to an individual, but it's harm to the system. So unless something changes, maybe with the statutory code or the courts find a way to analyze it differently, where they're finding that individualized harm, it will be interesting how that plays out over the course of the next few years.
It is, and I was always curious as to why Congress would want to. You see this trend away from the commanders, and yet that amendment actually tends to protect the commander.
For sure.
And I don't know that they did that intentionally. It may be that someone, and I don't know the legislative history, that someone was offended that there was such a thing as apparent unlawful command influence and that a defendant might walk free because the system looked bad. And I would argue that the way the system looks is critical to the public's confidence in the military justice system.
And it's not like it's not like a unique way or a unique lens to view cases through. Like, we have other tests that are similar to that. The one that comes immediately to mind is when they're looking at judicial qualifications and they take the Liljeburg factors. And like the third is, what would the public think when they're looking in from an outside view?
Absolutely.
So I get how there can be harm to the system and how that can affect an individual court martial. So, I mean, there's a balance that needs to be done.
And I agree with that. In fact, I didn't touch on that in terms of, you know, the decision that a judge would make as to whether to stay on a case. I feel very strongly that if there's even a hint of a problem, the judge should recuse herself or himself, because you're really affecting the entire system. So for me, maybe you've gotten this idea. I believe very strongly in the system. I've devoted 53 years of my life to it, and I want to protect it, and I want it to not just look good, but I want it to look legitimate. I want it to be viewed as, this is a fair system.
Yep.
So that when parents send their children to the military, that they'll have every confidence that they will be dealt with fairly.
Yeah, and it ties back to your first ideal, right? The discipline, the justice. If we're going to do justice, we owe it to the accused to be just. No, yes, sir, I agree 100%. Okay, finally, I know I said 4 points, 5 points, we're really only going to talk about four. The last trend you talked about was the increasing complexity in the military justice system.
Yes.
As a practitioner, I tend to think we try complex cases. I mean, I hope that that's true. But do you care to talk about that some?
Yes, I wasn't really thinking so much about complex cases. I was thinking about the complex system that we use to investigate and try the cases. And I really hadn't given much attention to this until several years ago when I read a law review article about the complexities in the United States Code, and the author used logarithms to demonstrate mathematically how complex the United States Code is. And, you know, part of that is that it's been amended so many times over the years. It's not like there is a single committee that sits down and says, all right, how are we going to fix this?
Yeah.
And so it just keeps getting added to. It's like that house on a hill that ends up with 30 rooms and 6 garages and, you know, numerous stairways, and nobody really thinks about what it's going to look like. And I think there's a danger in letting complexity get out of control. And I use several examples. Complexity can arise from ambiguity. It can arise from competing provisions. It can arise from a general rule followed by 3 exceptions and then exceptions to the exceptions and exclusions to the exceptions. You know what I'm talking about.
You sound like the rules of evidence. It's what you're talking about.
Right. And I didn't create them. I'm just teaching. But it's so true. I try to find a way to take the complex and make it simple. So I've given more thought to it, and I recently read a law review article where the author said that the issue of complexity is complex. And he really had a very negative attitude, and he said, you know, based on all of this, and he gave examples of complexity, he said, I don't see any solution. I think the solution is that whoever's in charge of drafting the manual, the regulations, thinks carefully about unintended consequences.
Yeah.
And looks carefully at all the provisions that may, you know, lead into it. So that if you are going to change a regulation or a statute, you really have to spend time looking at what might happen if you pass it in terms of the complexity. Because I'm afraid what happens is we're all just cutting the wood put in front of us. And so if you give me, I'm an action officer, you say, Schleter, draft this amendment. My job is to get you the amendment and not to question why or reason or try to argue as to why it's not needed.
Yeah, and it's especially interesting in our system where you have, you know, really two competing branches of the government that are prescribing the way we have to do things, because you have the code, which of course is Congress-based. Then you have the implementation and the RCMs and the MREs, which are executive based. And when they don't talk to each other, which we've seen because Congress is piecemealing changes to the UCMJ.
Yes.
And the president's piecemealing changes to the RCMs. And when they don't coalesce like entirely accurately, like there are problems that arise. And we've seen that like as there's been major changes, like the statute of limitations issue that came up 5-7 years ago in Adams and McPherson. We see the post-trial action being taken in Brubaker Escobar. I mean, there are gaps that need to be filled. Yes, sir, I 100% agree that we need to.
So we're in agreement. It is a complex system.
And I have no idea what I'm doing most days. It's the way I look at it.
Well, don't lose faith. Just hang in there.
Maybe one day I'll get it. We'll see. Well, sir, thank you for the sit down. Like that was hopefully very interesting for the listeners. I know it's very fascinating for me. I always like to talk broader justice principles. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
It's my pleasure. I'm honored to be here with you today. Thank you.
And for the listeners, we will catch you next time on a regularly scheduled episode of CAF Chats. Thank you as always for listening.
Thanks for joining us today for another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast. If anything you heard sparked a thought, we'd love to connect with you. Your comments help us create better future content for the field or the fleet. Reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram. The information can be found in the show notes for today's episode. The views expressed in today's podcast are those of the presenters and not necessarily the Judge Advocate General's or the Department of the Army or the Department of Defense.
Thanks, counsel, for both sides. And the court will stand in recess until further order of the court.